The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme...
Our parents never brought us to hospital and you'd end up going in with maybe four or five of your friends. Paddy Doyle was the porter on the desk. Very friendly man.
The story of Temple Street Children's Hospital, which opened its doors in 1872 with 8 beds for Dublin's poor. Also,
it started just with sort of footsteps on the ceiling, banging and tapping along the walls. It progressed to the bedclothes being ripped off and objects thrown about the room.
Haunted Ireland, ghosts, witches, and the Irish vampire myth. And who actually read the 1916 proclamation? A new claim suggests that it wasn't Patrick Pearse. And that's where we begin this evening.
Irish men and Irish women, in the name of God and of the dead generations from which she receives her old tradition of nationhood, Ireland, through us, summons her children to her flag and strikes for her freedom. We declare the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland and to the unfettered control of Irish destinies to be sovereign and indefeasible. The long usurpation of that right by a foreign people and government has not extinguished the right, nor can it ever be extinguished, except by the destruction of the Irish people.
Well, if you ask any Irish person to identify the most potent symbols of the Easter Rising, they'll probably point to the GPO and the Proclamation of the Republic. And one of our most iconic images of 1916 is of Patrick Pearse reading that proclamation outside the GPO. But did he actually do it? A new book claims that, in fact, Pearse probably did not read the proclamation and that it wasn't read outside the GPO at all. I'm joined by historian Anne Matthews, author of The Irish Citizen Army, and Ruaidhrí O'Donnell of the University of Limerick joins us from our Limerick studio. You're both very welcome indeed. Anne, what is the evidence? Because we have been brought up on the assumption, or at least the holy writ, whatever you want to call it, that Pearse read the proclamation. Some say on the steps of the GPO, even though the GPO doesn't have any steps. How did you arrive at the conclusion, or at least how do you advance the possibility that he didn't read out the proclamation, on steps or otherwise?
Well, I came across it almost accidentally when I was doing my PhD, when I was publishing Renegades. I went with the given story that Patrick Pearse read the proclamation at the GPO. And I read everything anyone had to say about it that was published, and everybody was agreed that he did. And then when I was doing some research for the Irish Citizen Army story, and I came across a newspaper called the Dublin Saturday Post, which no historian appears to have used. I didn't know about it myself until about 5 or 6 years ago. And it had a wonderful account, an amazing account of what happened in that 6 days. And I believe also it's the paper on which John O'Casey based his Plough in the Stars. And the reporter is J.J. O'Leary, and he gave a moment-by-moment, time-by-time account of everything that happened in O'Connell Street. And he described, at 1:30, they came from the post office, a small man in plain clothes with a bundle of papers under his arm. Escorted by a guard of revolutionaries, he made his way to Nelson's Pillar and began to speak, surrounded by not more than 30 men. And he said, "Citizens of Dublin, the last of the public buildings of the city is now in our hands. We've captured the General Post Office, and on this Memorial Day, Ireland, as a republic, has freed herself from the Republic of England." And then he says the speaker went on to read the proclamation, and the newspaper printed the proclamation.
Okay, a small man in plain clothes does not sound like Patrick Pearse. He was not particularly small, he was not wearing plain clothes. He was wearing a uniform, a very distinctive uniform.
He was.
During Easter week.
He was. And James Connolly was a small man, but he was wearing the Citizen Army serge green uniform. To me, that's Tom Clark. And it makes sense. Now it makes sense, having read this, Tom Clark was the old Fenian.
He was the link.
He was the absolute living link. Whereas in 1915, Pearse talked about the dead generations and the dead Fenians. Here they have a living link. And it made sense that they gave him the honour of reading the proclamation, it also makes sense, it makes more sense that they read it at Nelson's Pillar, because the GPO was simply that, the GPO. It was a public building, it was open because it was Bank Holiday Monday, but nonetheless not an important building or iconic building. But Nelson's Pillar was iconic. And those words where we have separated ourselves from the Republic of England, it makes sense that it would have happened at Nelson's Pillar.
And do we know, was Tom Clark wearing civilian clothes that week?
He was not in uniform.
Yeah, okay, that's what I would have expected. Ruwan, what do you make of this? Do you think that it is possible that somebody other than Pierce actually read the proclamation?
Well, I think the balance of probability is no. But I say this with total interest in Anne's theory, which I think is important. There are no sacred cows in Irish history. We need to get into and reevaluate all of these things. It must be pointed out, of course, that it's not simply that historians have claimed that Pierce did it. For decades, it was assumed and reported and printed that he did, which means that for decades, none of those present at any of these events took any issue with that. That's one point. It's also significant that several documents were read in several locations, and it may be that Anne has found yet another one. I would be amazed, for instance, if it was Tom Clark, although I'd like to think it was, and her logic is perfectly sound, because Kathleen Clark, a famously zealous and loyal devotee of her martyred husband, was extremely committed to ensuring that he was not done out of any praise. Skellig, J.J. O'Kelly, has an account. I don't believe he witnessed it, but his account is typical of the contemporaneous. By 1 o'clock, the proclamation of the Republic was read aloud by P.H. Pierce. And he goes on to say, very honestly, its chilling reception by those within earshot saddened the hearts of listeners and of spectators who longed for Irish freedom. Now, the guy who's the real authority of the proclamation in terms of its production and aspects of its utilisation is John O'Connor, in his very fine work, The 1916 Proclamation. He says, for instance, that shortly after noon, Pádraig Pearse, to be precise, standing beneath the high portico, read the proclamation publicly. Now, if that's not true, I'm very surprised it hasn't been comprehensively contradicted. But can I make one more point, before you come in?
Absolutely.
It is also the case that Pearse read a second document on the Tuesday, the following day, right? And this is the one that the amended notes of Dermot Lynch, who was an eyewitness and a participant, provide an important issue. In the amended form, it's not just the date of it that's amended from Monday, in other words, the first day to the second, Tuesday, in the manuscript. It's also the title. The Elysian covers 7 or 8 words, probably, and someone could probably estimate that, and it's replaced with handwritten words, Manifesto to the Citizens of Dublin. This is about the Tuesday. Now, that is the Provisional Government to the Citizens of Dublin, the second document, which is endorsed P.H. Pierce, Commanding-in-Chief of the Force of the Irish Republic and the President
and
of the
Republic. And that's the document that Dermot Lynch, in his witness statement to the Bureau of Military History, is talking about. That's the event that he's talking about, not the reading of the proclamation.
In the original version, he's referring, I believe, by the basis of Monday and the correction to the proclamation. In the final version, which he's worked on, it's page 4 of his supplementary statement on the events of Easter week, it's changed to Manifesto to the Citizens of Dublin. However, it doesn't contradict anything because he's nothing to say about the proclamation per se, what we call the proclamation, whereas other contemporaries did.
Now, the timing is interesting here because you talk, Rowan, about evidence that about Skellig, about J.J. O'Kelly talking about Pierce reading the proclamation at noon. This statement here from the Dublin Saturday Post refers to this proclamation, or the small man in plain clothes reading this bundle of papers at 1:30 in the afternoon. So they could be two separate events, couldn't they?
Moreover, we have to bear in mind there is no authoritative actual contemporary record. This is a scattered affair by hundreds, if not thousands, of people and spectators. Skellig says by 1 o'clock. Lynch, in his original verse, says about 12:45. He originally was talking about Monday, he changed that to Tuesday. So we have to bear in mind there's a huge amount of chaos of war. But one further point, the reading of the proclamation by Pierce is additionally logical due to his near obsessive adherence to the legacy of the continuity principle of Robert Emmet. That's what Robert Emmet did on the 23rd of July 1803 outside the Thomas Street Depot. And similarly, Emmet's
Second in command, Philip Long, had also issued a document to the citizens of Dublin, which is precisely what Pearce did. So there's an internal Republican ideological logic to what went on.
This is the only account where somebody says very clearly a man came out and read the proclamation. And the man I am saying is Tom Clark. He did address the citizens of Dublin. And it also makes sense that if you want to draw a line from Emmet, well, then Clark is a link between Emmet and Pearce.
Oh, I agree with you entirely. Yeah. It's just Thomas McDonagh apparently also read the proclamation in Jacob's Factory, right? So there's a lot of things going on in a lot of places. That's not very well known. It may not even be satisfactorily established. In fact, I think we're going to find, as more accounts come out of the woodwork in private papers and private memoirs, that we will get a bigger picture beyond the BMH.
OK, well, at the very least, the fog of war has cast some doubt on who did or did not read the proclamation, Anne.
Yeah, I am not rejecting the existing narrative, I am questioning the existing narrative.
Fair enough. Okay, you were also questioning the existing narrative when it comes to whether or not the proclamation was read out to the rebels before they went to the volunteers, before they went into action on Easter Monday 1916. You don't think it was. You say it wasn't.
Yeah, I was working to the Citizen Army, I was a lecture given by Brian Hanley, who made an absolutely cogent point that the only people who knew what was in the proclamation when they left Liberty Hall were the leaders and the printers, because it was such a secret document, they couldn't allow anybody to possibly leak it overnight. So when they marched out from Liberty Hall, most of those men and the women did not know what was in the proclamation. It was read after they had gone out and taken positions.
Okay, but are you suggesting, therefore, that if they did not have the proclamation read to them, that they didn't really know what they were fighting for? Surely they knew what they were fighting for. They knew what they were there for.
Well, I think the hundreds of people who were interned and released on the basis that they didn't know what they were doing and they didn't know they were going out to form a revolution, and the fact that they were released says a lot.
If they didn't know what they were doing after the St. Patrick's Day manoeuvres, they were definitely in the wrong place. I think they absolutely knew what they were doing. In the case of McDonagh's reading of the proclamation, inside Jacob's factory, people were given the opportunity to leave if they wanted to. But you would have been pretty damn naive not to realise that by assembling on that particular occasion, in defiance of the countermanding order, that something was afoot.
Yes, absolutely, something was afoot. But they still did not get to hear or have the proclamation read to them before they left.
Not.
Which is my point. That's my point.
And does
that,
in any sense, as far as you're concerned, Anne, delegitimise what happened?
No, it doesn't legitimise anything. It's simply, here is the narrative. And they didn't know when they marched out that this was what was in this document. They discovered in the aftermath of the event, if you like, once they took the positions.
Okay.
That's
saying. If we accept the premise that they didn't know what was in the document, surely, Rouen's point is correct. They knew what they were doing. They knew what they were there
for. Well, we've been told over the decades that it was an absolutely secretive event. Apart from Liberty Hall, and what was happening in Liberty Hall, the marching, everything that they were doing, the bringing in of arms that they tried to bring in down in Kerry, all of that, yes, they were working towards an object, but everybody didn't know. Every people knew bits and pieces, but nobody had the whole story.
Well, is that not the case with revolution? A very small number of people.
Yeah.
It's not a good idea, particularly given the Irish experience of revolution, that everybody knows what's going on.
Yeah. But this is not about whether they did or did not agree with the revolution before or afterwards, or whenever they heard the proclamation. What I'm saying is the proclamation, which we are being told it was the most important document, and they marched out to fight and die for this document. They didn't, because they didn't know what was in it until after they'd marched out. That's my point. I'm not saying it legitimises or delegitimises anything. I'm not using any of that language.
Rowan, final word?
Well, I agree with Anne. She's literally correct there. They couldn't have known it was the proclamation. Only a handful in the inner circle did. But I'm sure that they accepted its tenets, and the fact that others continued to rally to the positions in the aftermath of the proclamation being distributed is quite telling.
Anne Matthews and Rouen O'Donnell, many thanks for joining us. And The Irish Citizen's Army by Anne Matthews is published by Mercier Press. There have been many unsung heroes in the story of Connemara over the past few hundred years, but one who deserves special mention is James Hack Tuke, an English banker and philanthropist whose charitable work during and after the Great Famine is now almost entirely forgotten. Between 1882 and 1884, Tuke assisted over 9,500 people living in remote areas of the west of Ireland to emigrate to America and Canada. Clifton historian Kathleen Villiers-Tuttle now tells us about the Tuke emigration scheme.
Long after the history books record that the Great Famine was well over in Ireland, people in the West were living in dire poverty, and a crop failure in 1879 virtually capitulated them back to near starvation. The Quaker community, who had been involved in providing assistance during the Great Famine, asked James Tuke to return to Ireland in 1880 and investigate what was happening in the remote communities on the west coast. Tuke toured for several weeks and observed that the government was obsessed with suppressing crime rather than finding solutions to poverty or improving the circumstances of the people. Poor families in the West were given a lifeline the following year when he published an article promoting assisted immigration to Canada and America. He then set up the Tuke Fund with money raised from private and government sources. The fund was in operation from 1882 to 1884 and assisted the immigration of about 9,500 people from Galway and Mayo to Canada and the United States of America. Entire families were encouraged to go, young and old, and even the in-laws. The stipulations were that one member of the family was to be able to speak English and there must be sufficient breadwinners among them to support the family group. The fund committee persuaded two shipping companies to call at Galway Port so as to avoid the expense of transporting passengers to Queenstown or Liverpool. In 1882, the Allan Line and the Beaver Line sent ships to Galway and 1,276 passengers left in April and May of that year. Further immigrants were sent out in 1883 and 1884. A great deal of work went into selecting suitable families. Each immigrant was provided with new clothing and careful arrangements were made for their reception on the other side. Those arriving in Canada were met and taken charge of by agents from the Canadian government, while supporters of the scheme met those arriving in Boston and Philadelphia. Great care was taken that the immigrants would be in a position to obtain work, for, as stated in the reports of the committee, although mostly destitute, the adult immigrants were able-bodied, capable and willing to work. Others were provided with rail tickets and sent by train to join family or friends further afield. The scheme was at first lauded by all, and satisfactory accounts were sent back on the successful integration of the immigrants. However, as economic conditions began to improve in Ireland, the Tuke scheme attracted opposition from both Irish politicians and the Catholic Church, and it was brought to a close in 1884. James Tuke died in 1896 at the age of 75. He is remembered in the minute books of the Clifton Union as a really true philanthropist. His work in instigating and managing the immigrant scheme was instrumental in saving thousands of people in the West from poverty and wretchedness.
And if you'd like to hear more about Mr. Tuke's fund, a conference dealing with Connemara emigration in the 1880s will be held in the Clifton Station House from next Friday, the 31st of October, until the 1st of November. Kathleen Villiers-Tuttle, who you heard there, will be among the speakers. Full details on our website. After the break, we'll be exploring a very different aspect of our history. Temple Street Children's Hospital. Welcome back.
You smoke?
When I was a little boy, two big boys brought me down the street and they gave me a smoke, a pull of a cigarette, and me fired off now. And when I went home that evening, me mammy said, "Where were you?" Says, "I down the street playing with Levo." And says she, "But are you sure of that?" And says I, "Certain of it." And she come here.
Wait a minute, did she know you were smoking?
Yes, sir.
Somebody told?
Yes, sir.
All right. Did you get a walloping?
I got a flogging.
They certainly don't make them like that anymore. Paddy Crosby there with Thomas Walsh in the 1950s on The School Around the Corner, portraying what a 1950s audience at least saw as a lighter side of childhood in the city. One building that's been a witness to countless generations of growing children is Temple Street Children's Hospital, which is, of course, smack in the middle of the capital. It's been there since the 1870s, and I'm joined by the hospital's resident historian and archivist, Barry Kennerk, who's just brought out an illustrated history of this famous institution. Barry, you're very welcome indeed. It originally opened in 1872, handful of beds, very small.
That's right. It opened in Buckingham Street, not too far away from its current location. Originally set up to cater for Dublin's poorest children, it wasn't all that different to a lot of other Dublin charities, except for one crucial factor. It cared for children in a specific environment of their own. The people who set it up were lay women. And within a very short space of time, within 4 years, the hospital had such a volume or an influx of patients that they had to hand over to the Sisters of Charity. These were some of Dublin's poorest children. Imagine a child being so malnourished that it cried at the sight of food. Children where you could actually see, the peristalsis. You could see the food going down. They were so thin. You would imagine that you were in a famine-stricken part of Africa, but this was Dublin City. Children over 10 couldn't be admitted. It was just part of the policy of the hospital. And as I said, within 4 years, the sister charity had taken over. By 1879, they were looking for a larger premises, and that's when we moved up to Temple Street, where we still are today.
And the move was to a building with a connection to one of the greats, one of the giants of Irish history, Charles Stewart Parnell.
That's right. Well, initially they bought number 15 Temple Street, which had been the previous home of the Earl of Bellamont in 1879. And the home next door was number 14. Of course, it's where Parnell had lived for 5 years up until 1867. And they knocked the two houses essentially together. But there are stories about Parnell's time in the house. In fact, when I still go around looking up, I'm discovering new features all the time. Captain Ingram, who was the city's first fire chief, put out a fire when the Parnells were there. And the fire damaged rafters are actually still visible today up in the very garret, up at the very top of the house. So remarkable.
Ironic, given the subsequent fate of Parnell's mother in Avondale, the victim of a fire. Back in the 19th century, back in the 1870s, 1880s, when a child was admitted to the hospital, what happened to them? What was their experience like? What happened to them almost immediately?
Well, as I said, it was very Dublin-centred in the beginning, really catering for the poorest children from Dublin's tenements. Malnourishment, of course, just being one of the things that children came in with. Children came in with layers and layers of clothing, pieces of carpet, oftentimes because they were so cold. Children who were suffering from rickets. Rickets was extremely prevalent in Dublin. And then you had everything else in between, tuberculosis and so on. Lots of these children, when they came in, were quite dirty. They had to be washed. They had their head shaved regardless of whether they were boys or girls for lice. So that's the way they dealt with it. There were no lice combs. And so they were shaved. Their clothing was taken off them. They were issued with new sets. Oftentimes they were kept in for far longer than would be considered normal today, because there was a fear that if they were sent back to the tenement conditions from which they came, they would suffer a relapse.
The book includes many first-hand accounts and stories, and it's through these stories that we get a true sense of how poor many Dubliners were. We're getting this that sense obviously from Barry as well. Here, Michael Foran recalls being admitted during the 1950s when he broke his leg.
We had no car. Sure, the working class would never see the inside of one. So my father had to carry me down to the hospital. We got as far as Seville Place when a man in a Volkswagen offered us a lift. I can still remember the journey and your man's dashboard all lighting up. When I arrived, they put me in plaster of Paris and I thought it was great. Around 1960, 1961, I came back to be treated for appendicitis. I was pretty bad that time. My eldest brother, who was 16, used to come and visit, but I think he was more interested in the nurses than he was in me. The nurses used to do tremendous work in those days, things they wouldn't do now. You see, the hospital was like the engine room of a ship, all pipes, and it was part of the nurses' job to be down cleaning them and all along the bottom of the walls. Afterwards, the nuns would come along with their white gloves and run a finger along that way, just to check for dust. While I was there, Grace Kelly arrived to cut the ribbon on the new flats across the road. I remember the excitement on the morning because she was coming to Temple Street and the nurses were getting their hair all done and fixing their clips. They used to have photographs of her visit in the hallway, but they took them down when they were renovating. They might still be in a back office somewhere.
Yeah, I'm assuming that the photographs of Grace Kelly have walked.
They're good. They're gone. Yeah, at this stage, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another thing that comes across in the book is how relaxed previous generations were about things like the whereabouts of their kids, for example, as illustrated by this memory from Lorraine Robertson of Hardwick Street Flats.
In them days, we used to love scutting on the buses, which had a bar at the back of them. And they turned off Dorset Street into Hardwick Street. And we used to jump off at the top of the road, hold the bar until I got to Frederick Street and the conductor got on. If anything happened to us, me ma would send us over to Temple Street, run over there and get a plaster, she'd say. Our parents never brought us to hospital. And you'd end up going in with maybe 4 or 5 of your friends. Paddy Doyle was the porter on the desk and he used to have a big box of them. Very friendly man. All the kids loved him.
So the kids did not necessarily need mummy or daddy to bring them to hospital. Going back 100 years, back to World War One, the illustration on the front of the book, and it is a beautifully illustrated book, by the way, is of a nurse holding a rather portly and, I suppose, discontented-looking looking baby. But it's an interesting baby. It's an interesting child, isn't it?
It is. Her name was Julie Waden, and she was actually a Belgian refugee. And Temple Street was one of those hospitals which took in some of these refugees who'd come from the front. A number of Red Cross ships arrived in Dublin, and I suppose at that time the hospital was kind of mounting a PR effort of its own, because one of the doctors, Dr. Boyd Barrett, I think it was, said that there were more babies dying in the tenements of Dublin than there were soldiers dying in France. Now, that might have been slightly hyperbolic, but I think it did make a point. The hospital was suffering for lack of funds as well, because so much energy and resources were being ploughed into the war effort. But Temple Street definitely did play its part, and that picture is particularly important.
Did it play a part in the 1916 Rising? Because one of the things that Joe Duffy's work has showed is that we have, I think he's up to about 40 now at this stage, children who were killed in 1916. So there must have been a lot of children who were injured as well, who would have ended up in Temple Street.
Absolutely. It was one of the most fantastic discoveries I made when I went out to look at the Sisters of Charity archive in Sandymount. And I should say that the sisters afforded me complete access to the archive, which was superb. In that is a 4 or 5 page handwritten account of how the sisters dealt with the crisis during Easter week. Now, what I've discovered from looking at various accounts, among them those of Irish MP John Dillon, who lived nearby in North Great Georgia Street, is that Temple Street appeared to be not outside a theatre of war, which is what I had initially assumed, but rather was inside a secondary cordon. You had the whole area around Parnell Square, Hill Street, Drumcondra also cordoned off. And inside that, there was sniper fire going on. Belvedere School, where the Jesuits were, that took a particularly brutal hammering.
And Dillon himself was a prisoner, basically, in North Great George Street.
He was a prisoner. Week. That's right. Unusually, the milkman comes to call at one stage, and he didn't seem to be too bothered by the fighting, but poor old Dillon was hiding away. But adults and children were brought up to Temple Street. And of course, it was a huge struggle for the sisters, because most of the doctors lived at the opposite side of the fighting, around Merrion Square and so on. Only 4 of the doctors who attended the hospital lived on the right side and could actually get in. So you find that the Sisters of Charity were trying to administer anaesthetics, trying to cope as best as they could. Father Fahy, who was the rector of the college in Belvedere, came over to administer the last rites to some of the patients. And as he tried to leave the hospital, he was actually fired on by a sniper. Now, eventually, a man arrived by horse and cart to take away some of the bodies. He was actually killed as he sat up to take the reins. Dramatically, we find Fahy taking the reins himself. It's like something from a cowboy movie. Mm. The sisters then were involved after the Rising in a humanitarian effort, because, of course, a lot of the ordinary people of Dublin had really suffered in the Rising, and so they were involved in dispensing clothing and food and so on.
As the century progressed, a large number of children were admitted with chest conditions. This was a common complaint resulting from the damp, foggy conditions in the city's tenements. Among them was the author Brendan Behan, who took ill after standing at a rainy football match in Croke Park on the 23rd of September 1934.
I could have changed my clothes and got into bed. Only half Ireland seemed to have got themselves into our street looking for shelter. In our house we had a hooly, and the measure of our accommodation was not such that we could have a hooly and get into bed at the same time. My father played the fiddle, amiable as always, anything from the Blackbird to the Lady in Red. And we danced and sang the night away, till in very short order I got pneumonia and found myself in Temple Street Children's Hospital.
Staying with the 1930s, in this excerpt, Veronica Healy recounts her experience of being a patient at Temple Street in 1936. She came from a large family, and when she fell ill with rheumatic fever, it meant a 3-month hospital stay, much of it spent in complete isolation from the other patients.
When I arrived, they had no bed for me, so I spent my first night with my knees up in a cot. Don't move, they told me. You mustn't move. My mother was not allowed into the ward when I was upstairs. There was a glass partition and I could see her through that, but she couldn't get to me. Underneath the glass, they had cupboards, so she used to open the door on her side, give him whatever she'd brought, sweets and that. I could open the door on my side and received him. And I was ready to go home after about 3 months. My mother came to collect me in a pushcar. I was so weak, I couldn't walk. She pushed me all the way back to Cabra and that. There was no such thing as a taxi or anything. I'd missed so much school and was so weak. My mother gave in to my pleading and I never went back to school afterwards.
The hospital was very reliant on voluntary contributions, Barry. So did they use young patients, understandably, the circumstances, to stir up the sympathy of potential donors?
I think there was always a particular emotional appeal with children that was seen right through the First World War, when you had some of the newspapers, not just in Ireland but in England, using the child casualties to show the impact that the war was having. A baby club was set up in Temple Street in the 1930s. And this was the forerunner of the current public health nurse system. All of their work was publicised in Dublin's newspapers. They very much wanted to reach out. Rather than just treat children reactively, they wanted to provide a very proactive type of healthcare where they dispensed milk powder to families, that they weren't just treating their illnesses, but they were also showing young mothers how to look after a home, how to knit, how to cook, how to care for a very large family. They dispensed charity. They gave out bread to poor mothers on the laneway in the evening time. And I think it definitely helped their fundraising efforts.
Okay, a memory from the late 1950s from Tom Burnell, who was admitted to the hospital for about a week. He had a piece of glass inside his foot and it had grown over, so they had to operate.
I remember the second floor with glass panelled wards and everything was immaculately clean. Coming from Finglas, being clean meant a Saturday night bath. The main thing I remember is the taste and smell of lukewarm tea from a plastic cup. Eek. Me dad used to bring me a brown paper bag with some sweets in it. He was a bread man and worked in Kennedy's Bread in Parnell Street. They used to stable their horses behind Kennedy's up the lane, that's just beyond the railings, and had wooden horse walkways inside with lathes of steel so the horses could get a grip with their hooves as they walked upwards. His horse's name was Tom. I often wondered if the horse was named after me, or the other way round.
An exhibition at the Little Museum of Dublin is also on to coincide with the launch of the book, and it covers 100 years of the hospital's history. One of the exhibits is a photo of a child called Phyllis Gaffney, who was the hospital's first incubator baby in 1952. But her story has even more significance than that. There's a very tragic backdrop to it.
That's right. Initially, we started out with this photograph of a baby and two nurses. We didn't know who she was. And when we put a public appeal out to try to get the stories behind some of the photographs, one of the people who came back was a lecturer in French studies from UCD, Phyllis Gaffney, as you mentioned. And it turned out that she was the baby in the incubator. What happened was that her father, who worked for Aer Lingus, he died in the very first Aer Lingus crash in Snowdonia. And her brother had died in a drowning accident not so long before. And obviously it was a terrible shock to her mother. And baby Phyllis, who was still in utero, was failing to thrive and she was delivered prematurely. And her grandfather, who was a surgeon, rushed her up to Temple Street Hospital and she was brought in. And today, I'm glad to say she's hale and hearty. But
she didn't have a great start in life.
She
so
didn't
two
have
and
a great
half
start.
Pounds.
That's true, which is amazingly tiny when you think of it. I mean, even by today's standards, a premature baby of that size would really struggle. But what a fantastic find. And it just shows you the benefit of putting out an appeal like that, because we've gone from a completely anonymous photograph to something that has this very warm human story now behind it.
Well, the exhibition at the Little Museum of Dublin continues until the 31st of October. Barry Kennock, many thanks indeed. And Temple Street Children's Hospital, An Illustrated History, is published by New Ireland. We've put some of the photos from the book on our website if you'd like to take a look. By the way, just a quick mention of a special reunion screening of the 1943 film A Dance Odyssey. That's going to be taking place at the Samuel Beckett Theatre in Trinity College in Dublin this Tuesday. the 28th of October. After the break, ghosts, ghouls, and the Irish vampire myth. Welcome back. Most tales of Irish ghosts and witches can be dismissed as pure fiction, but a new book which delves into the world of unexplained phenomena is supported by historical evidence. Haunted Ireland catalogues hair-raising tales of the unexplained and unknown that took place on this island. Lorcan Clancy spoke to the author Tarquin Blake and found out about the history of ghosts, vampires and strange goings-on around Ireland.
In a remote part of County Fermanagh, there's an old deserted cottage that's said to be the home of a poltergeist.
As I walked up to the cottage, I actually found the battery in my mobile phone had died, and also the battery in my camera had died. It was certainly an unnerving sort of start to the exploration.
Tarquin Blake has been photographing eerie abandoned buildings for more than a decade, so he's usually not affected by the spooky atmosphere you often find at these locations.
But on this occasion, I guess I was frightened of the location. It's a fairly lonely cottage. It's kind of on the edge of a forest. There's a little laneway that leads up from the road. It really is, you can't really imagine, a more uncanny sort of haunted location. A very sort of narrow laneway, all overgrown, trees sort of covering it. It definitely made me feel very much at ease.
In 1914, the cottage was home to the widow Bridget Murphy and her seven children.
They'd be living in this cottage for a number of years. It was in the autumn of 1914 when the poltergeist first let itself be known to them. It started just with sort of footsteps on the ceiling, banging and tapping along the walls. It progressed such that the young girls, the young Murphy girls, were pushed and poked by some kind of unseen force. Then it's kind of progressed again to the bedclothes being ripped off and objects thrown about the room.
After several weeks, it was suggested that these strange events might be some sort of twisted hoax devised by the Murphy children.
This was tested by a whole sort of gathering of people, and a number of men put their arms across the Murphy children and sort of held their arms so they could see that there was nothing untoward going on. And still the banging and tapping was heard on the walls. Actually, a number of the people who were holding the children, they actually got pushed and pulled by some unseen force.
In an old graveyard at Knockraha in County Cork, there's an underground vault known as Sing Sing Prison, which was used by Republicans during the Irish War of Independence. It was essentially a holding pen for prisoners who were awaiting execution.
It's kind of about 10 kilometres outside of Cork City in a very remote area. This is where prisoners were held. They were taken from this cell. They were blindfolded and executed. It's estimated that between 40 and 100 men were held in Sing Sing and then executed. There's well-documented cases of quite a number of men who were held in a cell, and they all recorded similar paranormal experiences. So some recorded angelic female apparitions. Others recorded the constant feeling of ghosts surrounding them and trying to murder them, and others just being constantly in the presence of the dead.
At Ballinagard in County Limerick, there's an old abandoned mansion. At one time, it was the residence of the Croakers, one of the principal families among the landed aristocracy in the county. In the mid-19th century, it's said that the master of the house, one Edward Croaker, had a close encounter with the devil himself.
One afternoon, a mysterious dark rider appeared beside Edward's carriage, and the two men then struck up quite a conversation that resulted in the stranger being asked back for dinner at Ballinagard. And it was here that festivities were kept up fast and furious late into the night, with both men in the end falling into a drunken stupor. It was sometime later that the servants carried the two drunken men back to separate bedrooms, where on removing the stranger's boots, they discovered that he had cloven feet. Then the following morning, as the servants informed Edward of this, he kind of rushed through to discover the stranger disappeared, but there were two prints of red-hot hooves apparently seared into the floor. It's completely in ruins now, so it's a very fine mansion house gone to rack and ruin. It is considered haunted, and like a dark rider has been reported in the area on many occasions.
Legends of vampires have existed for thousands of years across many cultures around the world. When Bram Stoker created Dracula, he was inspired by the vampire tales of European folklore, like the Irish legend of the Darrig Dua.
It relates to a location in County Wexford where there was a beautiful maiden and she was in love with a local peasant. But her father thought that with her beauty she should be married to someone of far more importance in the neighbourhood. So he arranged for, it was an arranged marriage to a wealthy local landlord. This poor girl, she was heartbroken and she actually chose to end her life with her own hands. And it was just a few nights after her burial that she rose from the grave and was apparently seen luring her father and her husband to their grisly deaths where she actually drank all their blood. And the story goes that she still rises from the earth every few years to tempt men to their death, and she then drinks their blood. It's suggested that the legends of these vampires and other similar legends, they contributed to the basis of the greatest of the vampire tales, Dracula, which was written by the Irishman Bram Stoker in 1897. And some say that the name Dracula was actually derived by Stoker from the Irish Drac Ola, which means bad blood.
Lorcan Clancy reporting there on some of the unexplained phenomena that can be found around the country. Tarquin Blake's book, Haunted Ireland, is published by the Collins Press. In that report, we heard about legends of Irish vampires. The myth of the vampire is widespread in many cultures, especially those of Eastern Europe. The concept of vampirism, which is the belief in these blood-sucking evil spirits and their malevolent deeds, has a long and nuanced medical history as well. I'm joined by consultant psychiatrist Dr. Brendan Kelly, who studied this area as well as the origins of the vampire myth. Now, Brendan, obviously, the most famous fictional vampire is our very own Count Dracula. I say our very own because he was invented by Bram Stoker. There was a medical influence, but there was a huge medical influence in the Stoker family, wasn't there?
Stoker came from a strong medical family. Three of his brothers qualified as surgeons. And this influence is very clear in Dracula, which is a fantastic read by any standards. And the account of the blood transfusion that's given to Lucy in it is, for example, very similar to the account provided in the Dublin Journal of Medical Science in 1870. Dr. Robert MacDonald had done the first blood transfusion in Ireland, in Dublin, around 5 years earlier. And his description, his vivid description of that in the journal, is very much echoed in Stoker's novel. So there's a strong medical influence.
Is there a psychiatric dimension as well?
Oh, there certainly is. In the novel Dracula, there is a psychiatrist, a 29-year-old psychiatrist who has an entire asylum under his control. And in it, there's a patient, Renfield, who has what's called zoophagia and appears to be, to a greater or lesser degree, a vampire.
Mm. Where does the classic vampire myth come from?
Stoker was repackaging the stories from Transylvania and from Eastern Europe, but the vampire myth seems to have bubbled to the surface of pretty much most cultures in one way or another. So in response to your question, where does it come from? It seems to come from deep within the human psyche.
I mean, there are biblical references to it to some extent.
Sure,
there
are references in Leviticus. There are references in almost all religious traditions, in almost all literatures throughout the world from all continents. And there's a remarkable similarity in the way that they come forth.
Mm. Now, purported outbreaks of vampires have been taken very, very seriously by authorities throughout history. Tell us about a case in Serbia in 1755.
Well, the Austrian Empress Marie Theresa had to send her personal physician to certain Serbian territories because there was widespread panic about vampires. Two people had allegedly returned from the dead. Now, what's interesting is her physician concluded there was no evidence of vampiric activity whatsoever, but this didn't quell the hysteria and the panic. And it's one of the features of the vampire myth is that whenever it appears, it grabs hold of people's imagination and it gets spread and developed. So, for example, early vampire myths were very, very dark and somewhat bestial. Whereas nowadays, with the Americanization of the vampire and the prettification, if you like, of the vampires, sympathies appear to have shifted. Nowadays, we're supposed to feel sympathy for vampires because it's difficult for them to get blood. They live forever while other people die. And now we're supposed to empathize with them as opposed to fear them.
And what are the factors that do you think actually fueled the belief in vampirism, the creation of this myth?
Well, often there are incidents that trigger a vampire panic. So, for example, someone who is dead, their body may be dug up and it may appear less decomposed than one might have expected. And then this leads to general hysteria. Or a person who has travelled far away is imagined to be dead, suddenly reappears. And this triggers hysteria, which then takes on a life of its own and gets reflected in literature, in plays and in all kinds of media. So any incident can be seized upon and developed by a crowd.
Now, in 1999, in the same publication that you mentioned, mentioned having inspired Stoker, the Irish Journal of Psychological Medicine. There was a case report published. You were involved in the publication of it. You co-wrote it, and it was on the subject of vampirism. Tell us about that.
Well, this was the case of a gentleman who presented to a hospital saying that he believed he was a vampire, and he was in search of the hospital's supply of stored blood, as he did not want to hurt anybody by biting them. So he was clearly in a state of some distress, in a state of some confusion. And the staff at the hospital said, OK, you know, we think we can help you, but rather than getting you blood, we're going to get you a psychiatrist to come and talk to you. And this person turned out to be quite clearly deluded or mentally ill. But there's a very important distinction to be drawn between people who have a delusion, that is to say, believe they are a vampire, and people who behave in a vampiric way. There are now vast networks of people who engage in vampiric acts. There are vampiric websites, all kinds of vampiric paraphernalia available on the internet. And these people are what might be called lifestylers rather than people with delusions.
And while researching this particular paper, you looked at some of the medical literature on vampirism. What did you find there?
Well, there are two main strands to the literature. Vampirism has been linked with certain medical illnesses like tuberculosis or pellagra. And these are kinds of disorders where people might appear pale, might be malnourished, and might have benefited at one point or other from blood transfusions. The other side to the literature was the psychiatric or psychoanalytic side, which is where analysts, in a very Freudian or Jungian way, analysed vampiric beliefs and behaviours and came to all kinds of startling conclusions about what it might represent.
Did you come across specific case studies about individuals relating to vampirism?
Yes, there was a series of cases presented in the world's leading journals like Archives of General Psychiatry, and many of them were of auto-vampirism. So, for example, there was one gentleman who could cut an artery in his arm and manipulate it such that he could drink a jet of his own blood, and that was known as auto-vampirism. And there were other people who traded blood for various other kinds of favours, shall we say, in the prison system. So sometimes the vampiric behaviour served an apparent psychological purpose, and sometimes a more mundane economic purpose in a closed system like a prison.
And is vampirism a genuine clinical condition, or is it still just a very powerful myth?
It's a very powerful myth. And certainly the way that psychiatry is practiced today, we would say that a person who believes they are a vampire has a bizarre delusion. That is to say, they believe something that's very unusual. It could equally be something else. So, for example, the man I saw who believed he was a vampire was from Eastern Europe. Perhaps had he been from a country where the vampire myth is less prevalent, he might have believed something quite different.
And since writing that article, which was back in 1999, you've delved deeper into the history, the medical history of vampirism. What kind of things have you discovered?
Well, Dr. Seamus McSovna and myself delved into the psychiatric history because we were interested that in the 1950s, people who said they were vampires tended to be psychoanalysed, and conclusions were drawn regarding the fulfilment of oral needs, the need to control other humans, and the need then to merge with another being, because when the vampire feeds upon someone, that person too becomes a vampire. So these are very rich, detailed interpretations from the 1950s and 1960s. Whereas today, with our modern diagnostic systems, we would just say this was a bizarre delusion. So what we were interested in was what we called the loss of meaning in psychiatry, where the modern classification systems don't really delve into the meaning of the symptom for the individual. For example, it's an interesting question. Why does someone believe that they have become a vampire as opposed to believing something else, like that aliens or the internet is controlling their brain?
Now, the paper that you wrote in August of 2011, which was called Vampirism as Mental Illness, Myth, Madness and the Loss of Meaning in Psychiatry, what was the reaction to it?
Well, the newspapers covered the story quite a lot, and it tended to be covered in quite a dramatic, melodramatic fashion. Our paper was really an appeal for thoughtfulness when people engage in vampiric behaviour and realising that this can be a lifestyle choice, albeit sometimes linked with mental illness. So the newspapers covered it as if I was saying everyone who had vampiric behaviour was ill, whereas that was not the case. And then the vampire websites took up on the matter and claimed I was stating that everyone who was interested in vampirism was mentally ill. And nothing could be further from the truth.
So you were persona non grata amongst vampire websites.
I believe I am still unloved in the vampire community. And they still write about these papers and they still write about my views. And there seems to be a need to be rejected. They seem unable to accept acceptance.
Okay. I would be concerned if I was the object of the obloquy of vampire websites. Why is, finally, the myth so enduring? Is it just because it's a handy template for making scary movies?
It's a handy template for movies, for books, for all kinds of things. It's a very broad myth. You can project a lot of different meanings onto it. But most of all, the literature suggests that vampire movies and novels are so popular because they allow us to have vicarious satisfaction of certain psychological needs. In other words, by watching vampires biting people and drinking blood, we don't need to do so ourselves.
Brendan Kelly, unbeloved of vampire websites, thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening. In fact, that's all we've got time for in this week's programme. You'll find details of all our items on our website. While you're there, you can podcast the programme. Next week, our lineup will include food we ate during the emergency and, staying with the theme of eating, the tragic fate of a lad from Limerick who was killed and cannibalised by his shipmates in the 1800s. Many thanks to this evening's readers, Maeve Mooney, Marion Richardson, Kevin Reynolds and Dermot Byrne. Until then, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Yeti Redmond, goodbye and enjoy the rest of your weekend.